Welcome to the ONC PCOR Research Data Use Scenarios Workgroup Meeting Number 8. My name is Hilda and I will be your operator. At this time, all participant lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your line. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Priscilla Dulab.
Okay. Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone, and good morning for those on the West Coast. So this is our eighth meeting, and I think a number of you are sort of pretty familiar with sort of, you know, the flow for these calls. Just briefly, joining me on the call today, we have other members of the NORC team, Lauren Hovey, Gagan Jindal, Catherine Donaldson. We have our colleagues from George Washington University, Jane Thorpe, Lara Cartwright-Smith, and Elizabeth Gray. We also have Daniela Mika and Joanna Singerano on the call. And then we have our colleagues from ONC, Helen and Davion as well. I know there's a number of folks that are joining the meeting as we speak, and you know, we'll be sure to take note of your participation. So for the focus of today's call, we actually have three scenarios that we are going to be discussing with you in some detail. One on the use of sensor data for research. On our last meeting, we talked about the collection of PROs, you know, to develop a registry of PROs. And today we'll also be talking of a research data use scenario focused on the use of the patient-reported outcome data within the registry for a research study. And then we have another scenario on Alaska Native and American Indian population. So I'm hoping that we'll be able to get through all three of these. Daniela's on the call, and she'll be walking you through the specifics on each of these as well. And then we'll also give you sort of a brief update on, you know, where we stand in the process, where we are with respect to updating some of the previous scenarios that we've shared with you on these calls, and you know, what's the plan for the upcoming meetings. Okay, next slide, please. Next one. So just by way of a reminder, you know, we've been bringing this up at all of our calls, but you know, just to sort of refresh everyone's memory, for each of the scenarios that we are developing, you know, we are using these sort of key questions to frame some of the topics that we actually touch on. Okay, next slide. Daniela, I'm going to hand it over to you, and we'll bring up the first scenario on retrieving sensor data for research. And I know we sort of had introduced this one at the last call, but I think it'll be helpful to sort of just, you know, reorient the audience to the specific scenario and the specifics around it, okay?
Thanks, Priscilla.
Yep, this is it. Go ahead, Daniela.
This the scenario is fairly complicated and convoluted, and I think part of the reason for that is that I think that the issue around using sensor data from wearables is actually quite complicated, and in particular there's multiple parties involved. So the way that this was written is for coverage of scenarios where wearables are included in a workplace wellness program. That scenario has come up before in cases that I'm familiar with, and I don't know if others have familiarity with this. So we wanted to cover the different kinds of ethical issues that might be involved in using sensor data as part of participation in a program where you have another party in addition to the patient. So just a reminder for this case is that we're not imagining that there would be a covered entity involved in the data, but instead there is an agreement for participation in a workplace wellness program between a participant and their employer, and an agreement between the sensor company, the wearable company, and the participant. That could be tacit, or it could be explicit in the case of, depending on how things are orchestrated. So one of the things that I hope to explore with you guys today was just talking about what the expectations are for people that are using wearables in the context of an employer-sponsored program versus a program that they're undergoing for their own purposes, and the different ways that people are expecting to be informed about use of their data, whether it's for research or something else. And I've been fairly interested in people's exposure to things like Apple Research Kit, and how frequently they're encountering new standards for different levels of consent around those kinds of tools, which are fairly interesting as innovations that make it a lot easier to deliver consent documents for people that are using these kinds of devices. So I have a bunch of questions listed here, but I don't know that they cover all the issues that you guys might be familiar with, and I'll just quickly kind of run through them, and then hopefully open up to discussion around concerns that might not be covered here. So I labeled the sensor wearable company Healthy Sensors, and so there's some questions because they are not a covered entity subject to HIPAA. What are the ethical or legal obligations that they might be subject to? And then there's some questions around whether there should ethically be a difference in consent that is delivered as part of participation in a workplace wellness program and consent that would be delivered for research use of data outside of that program. And then these issues relatedly, what are the best practices for that kind of thing? Should the company that is delivering the data be responsible for administering consent, or should the employer be mitigating that? And then as these kinds of expectations are changing over time, they may actually change more quickly than longitudinal research protocols. And I think this is a general issue where technology may be moving faster than both policy and study design. But in this case, I wanted to bring up what kind of resource implications there might be for this. And then I think that there's different levels of sensitivity that might be present in data sets like this. So if people are reporting things that they might not want to be identified or exposed because they may have information they wouldn't like to share, that might come to different standards. And then finally I have here these questions that might be related to things that could be identifiable by their very nature. So voice recordings that are being used increasingly in applications, would those be subject to different kinds of considerations? And then this is implicit in all of the scenarios, but if you guys feel that compliance and regulatory offices and IRBs need more information around these issues, that would be a nice thing to discuss here as well. So let me open it up and get your thoughts.
Thanks, Daniela. So are there any questions or comments from anyone on the phone? Everyone's unmuted, so you can certainly feel free to just raise any issues or comments that you have.
Danielle, this is Ed Hammond. I have a comment, and my comment is that the scenarios that I'm familiar with, the sensor data basically goes into some type of flow sheet or something and becomes part of the EHR. And so it seems to me that the consent to use it for research are very similar to what I would do to do research out of the EHR itself. I don't distinguish between sensor data coming in and other data coming in from other sources. And typically the research would mix that data together.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I think that was something that was also brought up by our legal team as well. Is that, you know, once the data has been integrated into the EHR, it becomes subject to all of the same requirements that would normally go into data that was derived from a covenant. So I think that makes a lot of sense. We have a use case that we're exploring right now at USD where there's a wellness program and a claims provider, a very large national claims provider that is using this wearable data. And we're having a little bit of trouble navigating that because it isn't in the record and it's brokered in this case by the employer. And I don't know if anybody that has familiarity with sort of how the insurance companies might be dealing with this, because ultimately those are in this particular case it's a negotiation of premium discounts that we're struggling with, and so I don't know if anybody in that space has any experience with that scenario. But Kevin, do you? I don't want to call you.
Oh no, that's okay. I was thinking of jumping in. No, this is Kevin, and I'm with HealthCore, which is a wholly owned research subsidiary of Anthem, and I'm recalling a study that we did with Fitbit, but it was before I was involved at HealthCore. So I'll have to take that back offline and/or look to see if that was published and is out in the public domain, but I agree. I mean, it's great when things can get populated right into your EMR-based system, but it's a challenge when things are collected by, say, an Apple Watch or something like that, and then having it reside not fully integrated into Epic or Cerner or Athena or whatever.
I guess, I mean, a follow-up question for you, Ed, would be, did you guys have any trouble when you got approval for that study or when you were initially setting up the connections between the devices and I think it was Epic in your case. Did you guys have any challenges around that, or was that something that went fairly smoothly in terms of getting approval?
It went fairly smoothly. You know, again, part of this depends on your definition of the electronic health record. What we're doing is putting it into a flow sheet that is part of Epic, but it's a separate part. And then we use a filter and pass some information from that back to the primary care provider. But we're using Smart on Fire. Ricky Bloomfield's the person that's doing all of this, and it's gone fairly smoothly. It's still in a pilot stage, so it's not widespread yet. We have just a limited number of people that are using it.
Thanks. Yes, for my own benefit, try to follow what you guys are experiencing with that.
And we do have consent. We did get consent of all the people that are participating.
They're consenting for participation in research?
Yes, effectively. But the research is part of their patient care in a sense. I mean, it is not separate from the providers involved in care. The personal the PCPs are linked into the project. So and to participate, the PCP has to agree that they will be part of the project as well.
And how are you administering consent in that case? How do you guys is it part of what the PCP is doing?
We basically and we as the Royal, we hear Ricky is doing this, but largely the people that are participating are people that we know. And there are people here at faculty at Duke that are participating or are working in the healthcare system here at Duke. And so, and there is a documentation of consent. So it's not informal. It does have a degree of formal.
Are you storing the documentation of consent in the EHR itself, or is it separate?
It's not in the EHR itself, I don't think. I think it's simply a separate document that enables before the software is downloaded into You have to get the consent before you're able to download the software in your smartphone. So we're linking through either Apple Watch or Fitbit into a smartphone, and from the smartphone it goes into the flow sheet as part of your EHR. Although it is separate, it's not directly integrated into Epic. It is part of Epic as a flow sheet.
Got it. So are you using Apple Research Kit or something like that to get consent through people's phones? Is that the way that they're?
There's other projects that are doing that. Yes.
So, Kevin, we're going to reach out to you outside of this if you can, you know, maybe identify the paper that you mentioned on some work that you've done as well.
That's fine. I'm not going to be able to find it here in that amount of time.
No worries. Are there any other questions or comments? Daniel, did you have any follow-on sort of, you know, comments for this or questions for the group?
Well, I think that was really helpful. Thanks.
Bob Kalman, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to point out something that I think is probably already known and obvious, but since you have an employer here with the possibility of information flowing around, that you have to pay attention to the laws that regulate employers, GINA and the ADA, and forthcoming rules in both areas with respect to workplace wellness programs.
Thanks, Bob. Any other comments? Okay, then I'm going to move us along. And Lauren, would you mind bringing up the next one? Go ahead, Daniela.
So you guys that participated last time, you remember we had decided to split up the registry case into two different parts. The first part was just the act of creating the registries because there were so many complexities in dealing with how that would be created and what kind of things each of the covered entities were considering in the registry creation process. This scenario is oriented strictly around how the data in this kind of a registry might be used for research purposes or reused for research purposes when the primary purpose of the registry was for doing quality reporting, but with the understanding that anybody that approved to submit data to the registry would be also informed that their data might be used for research. And one of the complexities that was encountered in the California Joint Replacement Registry is that all of the different contributing entities had different interpretations of how PROs fit into regulations. So as a result, the registry contains a mixture of data that has been consented at the individual level, that has been released under a waiver of authorization to the registry, and different potentially even different terms of the of informed consent and documents, and different terms of particular protocols that each IRB had submitted. So this scenario creates a lot of challenges for how people might track that information and how practically you can use that data and under what circumstances. And I have several questions here that I think that maybe you guys could possibly comment on what you think the best approach might be when we run into cases where we have these kinds of heterogeneously consented or authorized repositories, especially, you know, this is one case where things might change from the different provenance, but things might also change over time. I think that we're expecting something like this to happen with changes in the common rule as well, and how we might deal with that going forward is an active question when we're trying to manage the research use. So the questions that I have here, I I think the first one is oriented around, you know, just that tracking process. And then sort of digging into that a little bit deeper would be questions around, you know, whether or not the data use might be different, or the regulations or practices around data use for research might be different if we have a scenario where we'd be contacting the patient versus a scenario where it would just be used for research purposes and not involve any identification or contact for the patients. And I think that there's a couple of questions that we put into this scenario around whether or not the fee would change the way that people are perceiving these ethical concerns. You know, most of the registries have some kind of data management fees so that they can, you know, they have a sustainable model for managing their data. I think that can you scroll down a little bit, please? I think that there is maybe just one more thing in the questions that I wanted to cover. Okay, and yeah, so then also some variations on the scenarios, you know, whether we might think differently about this if there were also considerations around sensitive information like depression. I'll just step back now and get your thoughts.
Kevin, go ahead.
so thanks, Danielle. I mean, I see this in a lot like the direction that we saw with some of the previous discussions, even the adaptable trial example and other examples where you have a signed consent. I wonder what the thought is within the group where a registry, either like a patient PPRN or whatnot, has gathered consent that says, in that consent, I can go and link this data to, say, administrative or clinical data. How then that gets perceived of the patient registry owner, say, calling up a large insurer, saying, hey, I have these 15,000 people who have signed consent, you know, give me the data on them, I have their consent, and or health systems to say, okay, I have this consent. How does that consent get managed? Because that, you know, the consent was collected and governed by the registry, the IRB that approved that, and its privacy board had governance really only over the patient registry. Now you're in a position where you're saying, oh, I have this consent from this member or this patient to get more data. Now I need it. And I think the flip side can be said the same way. What if the health plan or the health system had some sort of broad consent? How do they, and again, that's to their IRB and to their privacy board, how do they turn that table and say, well, now I want the patient reported outcomes that are in your registry, give it to me? When it's sort of like, but how do you manage that consent process and sharing not only the documentation, but also then these essential waivers of authorization given the separation of the two?
I think that's a really, really interesting question. I don't know if the anyone on the legal team have recommendations on at least what the obligations are for these different kinds of data holders under the circumstances that Kevin brought up. It seems like there's probably at least a little bit of guidance, but I don't know how frequently that's been encountered.
Yeah. This is Laura. So, I mean, I think that any potential future uses and things like that have to be included in the consent. So they're not giving a blanket consent. They're giving a consent for inclusion in this research. And then you would say in that, you know, who will be using it and how it will be used and that sort of thing. So that will be the boundaries for the consent.
I get that. If you collect consent that says, I'm going to get other data on you, that's fine that the patient has authorized that. How mechanistically do you then sort of compel these other organizations that weren't part of the consenting process.
Oh, I see.
To provide the data that was... Exactly. Okay. All right.
I wanted
to hear that.
The person would have to give consent for the organization to release the data. So it may be that you're connected somehow and you would transmit the patient's consent, but more likely that I would think the organization who's disclosing it would have to have the consent.
So in that circumstance, you could create a sort of a compound consent and authorization form in which the patient authorizes the release of their their information from wherever it lives.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, then whoever is holding that data would have to give it to you
mm-hmm.
because the patient has authorized the release. That's the only way to do it.
Right.
But you can do that in one document.
That goes to every party who holds it, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They might have to verify it, though, or do whatever their internal procedures
are. Yeah, that would vary by holder.
So this is Ed Hammond again. I think there are a number of scenarios involving registries, and HL7 now has started a project in which we're trying to create standards for registries, and one of the things that we're interested in doing is to have to create registries that may be used for multiple purposes and also include patients coming from different organizations. So consent to do research on that registry are going to have to be involving a number of different organizations and a number of different IRBs. It's conceivable that that we can basically restrict some of that research to a de-identified data, and so we're looking at those options and putting in it. But I think there are a lot of questions in terms of both using a registry for patient care as well as using it for research, and what are the distinctions that have to be made with those multiple scenarios.
Ed, have you guys already started to model the metadata standards around those questions yet? Because we're experiencing kind of a similar process for the data access framework initiative around CCOR, and in my mind, I think we should make sure that those standards are aligned, and I don't want to derail this call too much. But.
Yeah, I agree, definitely. We are working with an acronym that's called PCPI, and we're working with NQRN, which is National Quality Registry Network or something of that nature. So we're trying to engage AMA and others in doing this registry, and I very definitely think that we need to keep this coordinated with PCORI. Yes.
I just might follow up on that, because I think that these issues that people are raising here would be incredibly useful for PCORI or PCORNET and other stuff that SNI is doing, so that if the PPRN would like to model itself as a registry versus something that would be more like a clinical data mart, they would be able to understand what the different approaches would be, including transmission of those bundled authorizations and consents that we were just hearing about.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think we ought to make sure that happens. There are a couple of meetings that are being planned over the next 3 or 4 months with 2 different groups that are going to address some of these issues. So I'll try to keep track of that and bring it back into PCORIAT.
Thanks so much.
Lucy, go ahead. Lucy Jones has a comment or question. Go ahead, Lucy.
Yes. Thank you. As a patient, I have signed many consent forms, and as you all probably have too, you've noticed that they can be single space and several pages, and there's never a lot of time, and understanding every sentence in them is really difficult even for well-informed people. And so I'm going to make a comment that may sound really naive, but it seems to me that this project needs to point out that a patient signing consent at the point of care has no idea about research. And if there is a solution where a patient signs separately about research, I think that would be a great public service. Now, researchers might argue that that's going to create a biased sample, but we're weighing privacy versus research access here, and it seems to me that putting the burden on each institutional IRB to develop language or even process that enables patient care, but also enables researchers to access all the patients in that facility. I find that very troublesome.
I wonder, Lucy, if you know of any sort of guidance around this kind of thing. I mean, I think about, you know, how they have changed the good faith estimate formats and the formats for how credit card companies are reporting any policy changes that they have. They've actually created standards that require a more human readable process for at least delivering the information about how policies have changed and how they will affect.
I can't say that I've looked into this, and I can't say that I have an exemplar of how this might go. I just perceive this committee as being fairly high level, and I'm hoping that at least the dilemma can be presented. I don't think that you all are making recommendations, but there is a serious dilemma here in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Laura. I would just say this is one of many issues that, you know, the policy world depend on IRBs to implement correctly. And, you know, it's I'm sure there's lots of varying practices. But it's really up to them to make sure that the informed consent is correct, is gives all the information you need for the particular case, is understandable by the person, and then the providers have to make sure that the person actually understands. But it's one of those areas that is left to IRB approval, IRB, review.
Well, I think this committee or this project is in a position to point out what I just said, which is the notion of research and what that connotes for an individual patient desperate for care is completely unreliable as something that I would see as informed consent. And at the very least, this project needs to point out that that's a problem.
Absolutely.
Maybe there needs to be a whole separate stream now of data collection, aggregation, and use relating to research, independent of or at least separate from consent for care, where the patient really isn't thinking about it and the forms are very hard to decipher even for the well-informed.
Yep, that's a really important point.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't want to talk too deeply about it now if we need to move on, because I know you had a lot on the agenda, Priscilla, but I'm very curious, Lucy and others, if you think that the nature of those consents would change depending on the level of privacy of the data. So if you would think differently about what needed to be, what patients needed to be informed about, depending on whether their names were being released versus having a fully de-identified data set where all information under HIPAA regulations were removed. Do you think that there is any difference in the practices that if we were to develop a standard, do you think it would be different?
Well, I think that's a really good question that I might want to think about for 5 minutes, but failing to have the time for that at this moment, I'm going to say that I don't think that would make much difference. I think a patient being presented with language about research, an interested patient is going to start to ask questions and therefore eat into clinical time. And so I guess I would need to think about that, but off the top, I think I'll stick with my original proposition that the question of research resting on individual IRBs, all of whom have their own ways of doing things, is very problematic.
I'd like to see this end up back on the discussion point, because I think that there'd be a little bit, I think there are multiple kinds of consents. I mean, this is really consent on data. And to me, that's different than my participation in something in which my body is going to be interactive with the research itself. And if we were going to create a standard, it would seem to me that we could create standards easier for use of data than anything else. And maybe that's an area that we ought to begin to look into is what would be the characteristics of that. I agree totally having each IRB looking at this separately is a lot of waste of time and energy. So I think it's sort of come back on the agenda somewhere. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, and I think that there is a patient choice initiative. I don't know if anyone from ONC wants to talk about that because I'm very enthusiastic that that might cover some of these standards. But I don't know exactly what the scope is of that and how it intersects with this. If someone from ONC would like to speak to that.
I want to plus one to the suggestion that we bring this up again. It really is quite complicated. Thank you.
So, Jenny, I don't think we have Jeremy on from the Patient Choice Project, as far as I can tell. But certainly something that we can, you know, bring up with our ONC colleagues outside of this call, okay?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, because I completely agree with everything that's been said, and I'm wondering if we might maybe have a high-level overview for a discussion point on that and where that particular initiative is going, because I do think that my understanding of it is that is one of the things that they might be getting to in that project, but I think I'm not familiar with it enough to say that it would cover the goals that Lucy and Ed are describing.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. So, you know, perhaps we can do an overview of what's, you know, being undertaken on that project for the next goal. Okay, any other comments or questions related to this scenario? Okay, Jenny, I'm going to move us along. Lauren, do you mind bringing up the next one? Thank you. Go ahead, Daniela.
Good? Yeah. I've got an ONC call that I just hopped on.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you think about that?
I thought it went well. I mean, they seem
to... So we're hearing some folks on the phone that, you know, doing
right.
My... Your
they didn't really know
time.
Why these people in this article said this, so
right.
Like, let's trust CDC, right?
Yeah.
I'll try to talk to them in the background see how that goes. Okay, so this scenario is was inspired by some work that has been done in smaller subpopulations and some issues that might come up around small subpopulations that might have particular preferences. And so we focused on American Indians and Alaska Natives, but it's not necessarily specific to this particular group, although I think that there are some regulations that might come up with this group that we've discussed, and hearing people's experiences with that would be helpful. So the protocol that a researcher might have would have to be approved not only, in this case, not only by the researcher's IRB, but also by the Indian Health Service's IRB. And the study is also seeking approval or has sought approval from the tribal government. And that gives a second level of ethical review over and above what might have been considered by the researcher's IRB, and so this information is also consistent with some resourcing documents that ensures that the healthcare is not adversely impacted by the study, so. The eligibility criteria would be defined, and the re-identification risk is certainly an important consideration here because the population is so small. So we're assuming that IHS would de-identify the data and that all of the minimum necessary disclosure requirements would be adhered to here. But I think that even in the cases of de-identified data, the small population size could lead to people thinking that either an individual a re-identification could happen, or there's potential for
research findings that might create stigmas within that particular population. And so that's, you know, this is another consideration, that it might be that the findings don't individually identify someone based on their responses or their health status, but it might create some stereotypes around health behaviors or other kinds of health risks if the population was sufficiently small that somebody could be identified with it after research was published. And then finally, you hear this description of all of the different approvals that would be required for this research to be conducted. And there's this sort of question of whether people might not wish to engage in research on these protected subpopulations because the burden becomes so intensive and resource intensive that the juice may not be worth the squeeze, as people say in these cases. So I'm especially interested from hearing anybody that is experienced, is either a participant in this kind of research or as a researcher to get your thoughts on this.
And I don't see anyone who has a hands. Lucy, did you have a question?
Yeah, there were people who had spoken to you only had a 30-day time there, but somebody...
Lucy, go ahead. Did you have your hand raised?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I should have deleted that. Thank you.
Okay. No problem. Do others have any questions?
But, as long as people are thinking, I might say that we should take into account that this is a population that has been grievously mistreated for hundreds of years by our government, and that they are rightfully sensitive about almost anything that suggests that someone's coming in to see what they're up to or what they're like or how they behave or anything about it. It's not just a matter of small sample size and somebody being able to be identified. So I guess the question comes up whether the idea that research could be considered an imposition that needs an extra layer of approval and monitoring is something that could be highlighted in the course of this project. It may be true for other groups, whether or not the sample size is the issue.
I think that's a really good point. I also wonder if you want to look, if anybody has any recommendations. I don't want to keep on putting you on the spot, Lucy. But if anybody has any ideas about other kinds of criteria for identifying populations that might have similar concerns that don't already have these kinds of concerns in place, hearing either now or offline about how we might identify populations that should have some special considerations around data use would be, I think, would be great for our report outs on this.
Well, one thinks immediately about public hospitals, and there's plenty of data that shows that people admitted to and discharged from public hospitals differ in their demographics from non-public hospitals, and so that might be at least a place to start to think about this so that there's no suggestion that any researcher is considering that the population in one or more public hospitals is easier to access than other populations because they don't know what's up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point to do.
So I wanted to see if, Jane and Lara, I don't know if you had any sort of considerations for the team in terms of sort of this idea of, what type of additional protections would be required, given certain sort of subpopulations of interest. Is there anything sort of on the legal and regulatory side that we ought to be thinking of?
I would just note that, I mean, presumably if people are participating in research, that there is a benefit or a reason that they want to participate. So, I mean, they may not be inclined because of history, but I would remind people that you can always get consent, you know, even if there's a risk of re-identification. You know, that could be one of the risks that is disclosed to people. So I wouldn't want people to be excluded from research because they are part of a population. You know, I don't think that would help. So, you know, but it's certainly one of the risks that people should understand. But, you know, if the fact that somebody's a member of a tribe that's a small number or located in a particular place, which makes re-identification likely or more likely, it's one of those risks that should be people should understand, but it shouldn't prevent them from participating in research.
And I think one of the things that's come up just to share with the group in our internal discussions has been sort of the, in order to get consent, often you have to disclose identity so that you can contact, somebody. And I think even within an organization, like, that there's not necessarily very, very clear practices on exactly how that process should work. And so to a certain extent, in some cases, you know, to get consent, you're disclosing more information than you would if you were working with de-identified data. And that process as well can become fairly complicated. So, you know, to go back to the earlier conversation, you know, having some standards around that and best practices and particular considerations for certain populations would be very helpful so that individual IRBs or privacy boards wouldn't have to deliberate these questions on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm. And then on one of our, you know, upcoming calls, I think we will be discussing the scenario on the mosaic effect a little more. So it might be another sort of opportunity to, you know, bring this up with the group, right?
Yeah, I think that would be a good chance to discuss again.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments on this specific scenario? I don't see anyone's hands raised. So, Ron, why don't we go back to the slide deck and, you know, I can just do sort of some quick updates to the group, okay? Okay. Or you can just move us along, okay? So, I just wanted to sort of remind folks, can we just go back to the previous slide? Yep, this one, yeah, thank you. So we've actually been reaching out to this group and others who may not be on the call, asking for feedback on scenarios that we've presented. And, you know, we've actually been getting some very helpful sort of insights to help us, you know, refine the scenarios, but also to bring up sort of gaps and issues. So please, you know, look out for these from us. I think right now we have a few that we've reached out to everyone about, one on the scenario that we discussed the last time on collecting PROs for creating a registry. We've also sent out feedback forms on the scenario where we discussed obtaining consent from, you know, prison populations, one around obtaining consent from individuals that may be decisionally impaired, and then, you know, one related to sort of creating a multi-institutional unique identifier for research, okay? So, you know, we are working hard at the moment to make sure that we get all your feedback, so this is just a special call out. If you haven't already, you know, please take a few minutes to sort of look at these and see if there's any other comments or questions that you have about these that can help us define what we've already presented to you. Okay. Next slide, please, Lauren. Okay, moving along. So just a reminder that, you know, we have been posting all of the materials and some pretty detailed minutes from each of these calls on Confluence, so you will see all of that. I wanted to specifically call out that at the next meeting, you know, we are going to be presenting a number of scenarios related to precision medicine. So, you know, for those of you that are interested in that, you know, it'd be very helpful to get your sort of insights on that. So the scenarios that we've been working on are related to the use of genetic biomarkers for research, disclosure of genomic data to a minor, and, you know, managing privacy related to genetic data as well, okay? So these will be the three scenarios that we're presenting at our next meeting. And then, you know, we will be seeing you all again on March 30th at 1 p.m. So we look forward to seeing you all then. Lauren, next one. I think that sort of wraps us up pretty well. So here's a link to the website and the slides, and there's also some information that we have linked to on the Patient Choice Project, which Daniela had mentioned earlier on the call. And we can certainly, you know, have a couple of minutes on the next call where, you know, we can also give a bit of an overview of the project. Okay, I think with that, we are pretty much wrapped up. We wanted to thank everyone for your time today. Thanks a lot.
This concludes today's conference. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.